And he'd got a quite a good honours degree in law at Cambridge, and so he went into the law.
Where were you educated?
The usual sort of stuff: Dunshurst Hall Preparatory School near Rugby. It was 21 to 26, and then I went to Uppingham, following in my father's footsteps, 26 to 30. Can't say I enjoyed that very much. It was rather a gamesy school, and he was very good at games, and I wasn't. Well, I got, sort of fourth 11 and hockey and things like that. It wasn't really my scene. I was keener on music than games. And then, again, in father's footsteps, into Trinity Cambridge in 31 to 34,
And
which was great fun.
in what way?
Well, I was liberated from the sort of rather strict monastic public school system, and suddenly discovered what the world was about. And I remember the only advice my father gave me when I first went up was, I was 18 at the time, he said, or coming up tonight, he said, "All right, my boy, you're on your own now, so you can sleep with anybody you want, but you pay all the bills." And of course, that was a tremendous inhibitor of my activities. And so it was rather sort of simple over the things like that. But it was great fun. And I played a tremendous amount of hockey and tennis there, a little bit of cricket. And one ghastly rugger game. I said I'd never, never play rugger again after Uppingham. And I was stupid enough to play for Trinity Trojans, which was the sort of worst Trinity side, against St. Catherine's College 3. And we were beaten 66-0. I was absolutely exhausted running back from the halfway line to the baseline. Terrible. It was an absolute disastrous day.
Now, I think that you joined these St. John's Ambulance. How did you come to
That's
do that?
right. Well, rather a silly story. I got crossed in love by a beautiful blonde who passed me up for a man who had 1,500 a year, and I embraced healing instead of drink and more women, which most men do, sensible chaps. But I was in a rather silly stage at the time, and I joined St. John's Ambulance in, oh, it must have been spring 1939, I think. And then during the summer, I was walking down Piccadilly with my father. It must have been about June, I think. And just when he got to the Royal Academy, he said, "There's going to be a war." And before I had time to reply, he said, "What are you going to do about it?" And before I had time to reply, he said, "They're raising a new battalion of the Sherwood Foresters, and I can have you made CO of that." Well, I was going through a sort of slightly left-wing pacifist stage, and I couldn't believe my ears. I thought, how can any human being suggest that a man like me should be put in charge of 600 men's lives? It was indecent. And so I just, without thinking, said, "I'm going to join the medical corps as a private." And he stopped dead in his tracks. He said, "Good God, what will my friends say?" Well, of course, being rather an obstinate and bloody-minded young man, I was determined to go through with it to see what his friends would say. And I got called up by St. John's Ambulance on September the 1st. We went to the Convent of Zion in Kensington. And I had to do all sort of organisation of getting stretcher bearers going and all that sort of stuff. It was quite fun, but by the on the 22nd, that was on the 1st of September, on the 22nd of September, a number of us volunteered to for the hospital train service, as we were all on the military hospital reserve. But nothing came of that, and on the 1st of October, I was called up to the REMC. And I remember I got home at 1:30 in the morning from the convent, found my calling up papers, told I'd got to report the next day to Aldershot. So I packed up my car, all my stuff from my digs that I was in Rowland Gardens, drove up to Worksop, got there at, I think I got there at about 5:30 in the morning, woke up my sister, unpacked the car, had a bit of breakfast, drove straight back to London. Ran round London saying goodbye to all my friends and dumping various plaster casts and models which I was doing. and managed to catch a train down to Aldershot and spent the first night in the army on a 6x2 kitchen table in the VD hospital, which is the Connaught Hospital at Aldershot. It's extremely uncomfortable.
Can you tell me how you came to go into the intelligence section?
Well, that came about later. There was tremendous pressure on me from my father and all my friends to try and get a commission and stop doing this silly business, but I was fairly obstinate, and I was determined to go through the war as a private to begin with. And so I joined, was posted to 13 General Hospital as a private, and we were under canvas at Tidworth for a couple of months. And then towards the end of December, we were sent up to 24 Eaton Square because we were under embarkation orders then, given a week's leave and so on, and I spent most of my time in the 400 drinking brandy and gin. I remember one classic morning early in January, I'd been out drinking with a girlfriend of mine, and I got back to 24 Eaton Square at 7:40 in the morning, just in time for the morning parade. I had to go to sleep for a couple of hours afterwards, and it was terrible. If anybody had struck a match, I think the whole of Eaton Square would have gone up. And then on the 19th of January, we went down to Waterloo and trained to Southampton, put on a boat, and we got to Cherbourg on the in the morning of the 20th of January. It was very cold. We spent all day on the station platform, and eventually we were allowed out, and I managed to buy them, because I spoke fluent French, which was very helpful. And we had a... managed to get hold of a lot of wine and brandy, and all night we were in this wretched train in third class carriages from Cherbourg to Rouen with no corridor or anything like it. We just had to open the door to spend a penny out into the open air. We got to Rouen in the morning and set up this 1200 bedded general. We didn't get it going till about March. Terribly cold winter, very overcrowded conditions. And I remember we ate army biscuits and badly cooked bacon three times a day. We were standing up in the mud. It was the only funny food we had for about 3 weeks. And then gradually, I was interviewed once, asked if I would like to join the intelligence corps. But again, nothing came of that. And eventually, when the balloon came up on the 10th of May, 13 General Hospital was the one chosen to stay behind. It was very embarrassing. And gradually we were run down to a casualty clearing station until on the, it was about the 9th of June, they blew the bridges over the Seine at 1 in the morning, but we were operating until 4, and there were two very badly wounded chaps, and one of them was the son of a great friend of my father's, son of a chap called Mr. Justice Luxmore. And they didn't come out of the anaesthetic until 6 in the morning. Luckily, that coincided with the Luftwaffe having breakfast, and those of the 27 of us on the rear guard managed to get away into the woods at Evre, where we were bombed and machine gunned.
The woods at where?
At Evre, E-V-R-E-U-X. It's about 20 or 30 kilometres from Rouen. And from there, we went in gradual stages down to Rennes and Laval, and then St. Malo. And we came out on the last boat but one from St. Malo on June the 16th, which I think was the day that France collapsed. Then we were posted up to Leeds, and by this time I was only made a corporal. Instead, I thought I ought to be made a sergeant. I thought this was jolly bad news. And I marched into the sergeant major and said, "Sir, I want to apply for a transfer to the intelligence corps." This wonderful man, Busty Hand, said, "Christ, they don't take things like you." And so that made me very determined to go on with it. And I eventually got an interview, and I went up to the War Office, and I was turned down the first time because I only had French, and they reckoned that French was a redundant language. Everybody spoke French in intelligence corps. And I wrote to my father and told him this, and I didn't realise it at the time, but of course, from the First World War, he was a great friend of Sir John Dill, and who was then CIGS, and also Vernon Kell, who was running MI5. And I think he must have written to them, because after Leeds, we were sent down to Malmesbury in Wiltshire, and then put on embarkation for Egypt. And 8 days before we were due to go, a telegram came through saying I'd been given an emergency commission into the intelligence corps, and I was taken off draft. And I couldn't believe it. This is on the 23rd of November, 1940. And I was sent back to the depot at Crookham to wait for the official posting to come through. And while I was there, there was absolutely nothing to do. We had to report in the morning and report in the evening. And during the day, to keep myself occupied, I had a very nice so called Francis Listowel, who was, I don't know whether he's the 7th or the 8th Earl of Listowel. Nice chap. He was waiting to get out of the get into the intelligence corps too, and he and I taught each other semaphore with Morse, with Morse, you know, these flags. It's all we had to do. And 14 days later, I was told to report to the intelligence corps depot at Matlock, and I spent my last day as a corporal. I wasn't allowed to go to bed in the REMC depot as the other rank and wake up as an officer. And so I was sent into an hotel in Aldershot. And I had to buy my uniform from anybody, any people I could find in Aldershot. I'd go to bed a corporal and dress myself up as a second lieutenant the next morning and catch a train to Matlock. It was great fun. When I got to Matlock, I discovered that without so much as a buy or leave, I'd been put on the what they call the security IB course. That's I, capital I in bracket, small b, course. And I knew nothing about security at all. But I took to this like duck to water. And I think it must have been something to do because with my father's experience, because he was on Haig's intelligence staff from 1916 to the end of the war. And the War Museum's got a copy of his diary, so all his activities are recorded there. But he was, sort of people who were in his mess were Jimmy Marshall Cornwell, who's just written this marvellous book, what is it, Wars and Rumours of Wars, and Stuart Mingus, who became head of SIS. And there were a whole lot of others, quite well-known names, and again, the photographs of all this sort of stuff in my father's diaries. So I suppose intelligence was in my blood. And the other thing, of course, is that I've always had a slightly unorthodox mind, and regimental soldiering never appealed to me because it was also straight-laced, rather like I could never dream of going into local government or anything like that, or become an MP. It's really too ordinary for words. And so getting on to the securities counter-espionage side was absolutely fascinating to me. And we had marvellous lecturers. There was a splendid chap called Major Charlie, who had been involved with security at the end of the First World War and was in the Army of Occupation of the Rhine. And Basil Bartlett, whose sister Mary Malcolm was quite well known on radio in those days. I think she wasn't on television as well with Jasmine Bligh. Yes, I think she wasn't. Mary Malcolm and Jasmine Bligh, they were the two. And Basil Bartlett, of course, had been a field security officer with the BEF until they got kicked out of Dunkirk. So he really knew all about field security work from a practical point of view. And there was another chap, Bill Skilbeck. Skilbeck, I can't remember what his Christian name was, and Bill Brooker. And of course, both these two, Skilbeck and Brooker, turned up at the SOE finishing training schools in Bewley, and I met them later when I joined SOE. But the lecturing was absolutely first class.
Can you at this stage describe what the course involved and what its objective was?
Well, it was the objective really was to find out whether the people on the course were any good and had a what they call a sea nose, which was an inquisitive nose. They said that one of the difficulties of counter-espionage was sorting the chaff from the corn. And you've got so many stories of people who'd seen a spy and extraordinary incidents that had happened. And you had to have they had to try and find out whether the officers on the course had sufficient perception to have a sixth sense to follow the rumours that really mattered and discard the ones that didn't. Now, of course, this is an extremely difficult thing to do, and it's rather like being dealt a playing bridge. It depends very much how the cards fall, whether you make your contract or not, and it's very, very difficult to be right all the time. And a lot of people, of course, made wrong decisions during the war, and a lot of people got killed.
But are you not saying that there are no rules that you can go by? And if so, how could the course operate to tell you what rules you could go by?
Well,
we
were told about flexible controls instead of static controls. You know, we were always taught to put yourself into the position of the man, the enemy, who was trying to penetrate your organization. What would you do if you were trying to get through a perimeter fence, for the sake of it, to put it at its simplest? And you would obviously sit down or get some of your chums to sit down and watch exactly what the sentries were doing. Time was always on the side of the penetrator. You were in uniform, the penetrator was not in uniform. By the penetrator, I mean the enemy. In orthodox warfare, you can recognize your enemy because he's in uniform. And the IA, which is the direct war intelligence side, as opposed to the counter-espionage intelligence, which is IB, are always trying to spot units of the enemy formations. They capture one or two prisoners, interrogate them, and they can build up a sort of picture of what your uniformed enemy is like. But you can't do that with saboteurs and espionage agents. And so we were always taught, put yourself into the enemy's position. What would you do to get into a camp? What would you do if you wanted to blow up a transformer station or wreck some points or blow up some engines in a railway line or get into an aerodrome? And then, having tried to work out what you would do, you then had to work out how you would prevent this. And of course, the best way to do it is through flexible controls, because if you have fixed controls, fixed sentries, always changing at the same time, the enemy know exactly how to penetrate. And if you read any of the stories about how the chaps got out of Colditz, that is what we were trying to prevent. So you're always on the other side, looking at it from the opposite side of the fence all the time. Fascinating.
Did you ever discuss the different nationalities, like the Germans, as to whether they themselves would adopt flexible or static tactics?
I think it's fair to say that the lecturers, most of whom had World War I and certainly World War II experience, and a great deal of inter-war time experience of foreigners, had a pretty good idea of the German mentality. And they reckoned that the lack of sense of humor in the English sense, and they were absolute sticklers for discipline and recording everything that happened. They tended to have bureaucratic minds in that sort of thing. At this stage of the war, I'm not talking about the time when Skorzeny got going, and Skorzeny was the chap, Hungarian, whom Hitler appointed to ran the, I suppose, the equivalent of the SAS. He was the chap who fished Mussolini off the mountain at L'Aquila after he'd been arrested. I'm not talking about that type of mentality, because we reckon that we would have been really up against it if Scott's Inn had got going at the beginning of the war. So I think it's fair to say that the, certainly at 1940, the attitude towards the Germans was that we could beat them at intelligence work. We had a tremendous regard for the efficiency of our own intelligence service. That's what the people call the Secret Service, that's SIS. People talk about SOE as the Secret Service. It wasn't the Secret Service. It was the sabotage organization, which had to be conducted under a cloak of secrecy, but it was not the Secret Intelligence Service. Collecting intelligence was not our job. So we had a very healthy regard for the efficiency of SIS. Lots of books have been written since the war to blow it all wide open and say how inefficient it was. But we also had a very high regard for MI5, which was the internal counter-espionage service within the UK. And anybody who read the Ultra Secret and the Double Cross system and all that sort of thing will see how extremely efficient they were. I remember when I was on this course at Matlock, they told us that within 3 weeks of the outbreak of war, they reckoned that there were no German agents actively operating in England, and they were all either inside or under control. I don't know how true that was at the time. It was a good story, and it was very good for our morale when we were being lectured. And all this fortnight, this course, and at the end of the fortnight, I was completely hooked on counter-espionage and security, and I was just praying that I wasn't going to be given an ordinary job. And I could have been sent out as an ordinary field security officer. I could have been sent to Bermuda with the field security section and sat out the rest of the war sort of censoring letters and mail and looking for black men who weren't very keen on us. Oh, perhaps I oughtn't to say things like that now. But you've got to remember, in those days, we were very English and very white.
Can you describe a typical day on the course? What would be the daily routine?
Well, I remember first 3 nights I had the most... I never got any sleep at all. The man I was sleeping with snored. I've never heard such a noise, and I didn't get any sleep at all, so forget the first 3 days. Eventually I was moved to another room, and I worked. You'd get up at 6:30, and order you'd bring a cup of tea. It's, to me, having been another rank and having had to take the tea to officers, I really didn't. It was sort of the whole world had gone topsy turvy for me. And I remember I called the sergeant major sir the first day I was there. Anyway, you get up, a cup of tea at 6:30, and get up and shave and breakfast. I think breakfast was about 8:00, and then we would have concentrated lectures. 3 or 4 lectures during the morning, lunch, and then we were made to take exercise in the afternoon. Part of the training was that under no circumstances are you to get stale at your work, and you must have some time off every day, whether you like it or not. You must go out and keep yourself fit, otherwise you won't be able to make sense of the work you've got to do, whether it's in the field or in an office. And, of course, when I got into SOE, one forgot about that, and you worked and worked and worked 7 days a week, and eventually got so stale you couldn't answer questions, and you had to have a 3 days break. So the afternoons we would always have some exercise, and then there'd be more lectures after tea, between tea and dinner. Then we had dinner in the mess and usually play bridge with the instructors. I made quite a lot of money in that fortnight, I think. We'd go to bed certainly by 11 o'clock, because they were very concentrated courses. We had to take notes all the time. Between Well, during the afternoon and evening, when we weren't on lectures or going for a walk, we would obviously revise all our notes. And again, you see, we couldn't keep any diaries at the time, except purely social things. And so it's rather difficult to remember whether we had exam papers at the end of the first week or at the end of the course. Certainly we had papers to do on the various subjects of military security, because this was pure military security in those days. It was on this course, it was nothing to do with MI5 or the more highly organised forms of security. It was straight military physical security stuff that we were taught with. Because they assumed that most of the officers on the course would be sent out into the field as FSOs, various parts of the world.
Can you remember the titles of the courses that you did?
No. No, it'd be silly. There would be a good deal of history of intelligence work in the First World War. There would have been lectures on the structure of the intelligence corps as it then was, and we had no depot in those days. Mitchett hadn't started, and Winchester hadn't started. And the organisation of the Field Security Police, as they were first called, FSP, Field Security Police, how all that was organised, and how you ran passes and controls, and how you did elementary interrogations of prisoners and things of that sort, because all prisoners were handed over to the intelligence corps when they were caught at the beginning of the war. That's assuming that one was a field security officer in the field, and so you had to know what to do with prisoners and how to deal with them, how to interrogate them. And one of the interesting things, of course, was under no circumstances are you ever to beat up a prisoner, because if you beat up a prisoner, he finishes up by telling you what he thinks you want to know, and you never get the information that you really want. And I remember they told us that a prisoner is always in a tremendous state of shock, and so kindness breaks him down straight away, unless you're up against a real toughie. If you're up against a real toughie, then he's got to be dealt with by much tougher people. But if you get somebody who you think has got a lot of information, being kind to him and keeping him awake quite a long time is, you know, and rewarding him with a cigarette or something like that was one of the best ways of getting information. there are all sorts of stories, of course, about brutality in interrogations and so on, and oh, the British never did anything like the Germans did, and we weren't like the Gestapo, but there were some pretty nasty stories during the war.
Such as?
Oh, people get beaten up, and drunken soldiers firing off machine guns into prisoner of war cages and things like that.
Do you think they were true?
The veneer of civilization is very, very thin, even in England. And I remember all through the war, I used to think, my God, when I saw some of the people who were involved in our own organization and also in the regular forces. And when you look at some of the people who are in the regular army now, of all ranks, and you look at their eyes, you think, what a damn good thing it is that England's never had a Hitler, because we could run a much more efficient Gestapo than Hitler ever did, and it would be much more brutal, because the type of person that runs things like that is a rebel.